A mysterious syndrome affecting diplomats. A weapon? Something else? This man has theories, but he can't say a lot.
We fervently hope that the State Department is listening and understands that we believe that it is in their best interest for our report to be made available to the U.S. public.
Also today, beware of Russian election meddling, but not just in the U.S.
These are hackers who are responsible for just an incredible rampage across the internet over the last 5 years.
I'm Marco Werman. We'll also hear on the show how some Latino voters are firming up their presence across the country, including in battleground North Carolina.
We're not going anywhere. We are North Carolinians, and we are carving out space for ourselves.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Glad you could be with us today. Vaccine trials are happening all over the globe. Today, the UK government announced funding for phase one of something called a human challenge trial for a coronavirus vaccine. The process will require young, healthy volunteers to be infected with the virus in an effort to speed up vaccine testing. A company called hVIVO and Imperial College London have the contract to set up the first part of that process. Here's more from The World's Carolyn Beeler.
The idea itself sounds wild. Intentionally infect people with the very virus we're turning our lives upside down to avoid?
Obviously, when people hear about these trials, many people's immediate reaction is, how could it be ethical?
But Oxford bioethicist Zeb Yamraujic says it's possible if certain conditions are met.
One of those conditions is that the expected benefits of the research outweigh the risks.
In this case,
how many infections could we prevent if we developed a vaccine sooner, for example?
In a typical clinical trial, thousands of people are injected with a test vaccine and sent out into the world to see if they still get infected, naturally. That's happening now with several coronavirus vaccine candidates. But Andrew Ketchpole, the chief scientific officer at hVIVO, the company launching this human challenge trial, says that takes time.
Normal traditional trials involve many thousands of subjects and take many, many months to complete.
In human challenge trials, which hVIVO has been running for decades, a small number of healthy volunteers would be intentionally infected with the coronavirus after getting jabbed with a trial vaccine to see if it works.
What happens is because everybody is given the disease, you're able to determine efficacy in a matter of weeks.
These types of trials have been used for centuries, and in the recent past have sped up the development of typhoid and cholera vaccines. The agreement announced by the UK government today is just for the first step of this, a contract to manufacture and test a strain of the virus to use in trials. It still has to be approved by UK regulators and an ethics panel. If it is, between 30 and 90 volunteers could start being injected with just the test virus, not yet any vaccine, as soon as the beginning of next year. So far, nearly 3,000 people in the UK have signed up to volunteer for a challenge trial. One of them is Alistair Fraser-Urquhart, who's white.
I'm definitely convinced that a human challenge trial has the potential to get a vaccine or vaccines out of the population way more quickly than if we didn't run them. And I'm of the opinion that the risk is small enough to trial participants that we need to take that risk.
Fraser-Urquhart put off going to university for a year to work with One Day Sooner, a nonprofit group advocating for human challenge trials and signing up volunteers. He says it's helped him channel some of the fear of living through a pandemic into something that feels productive.
My gran might catch this. My dad might catch this. My dad is at risk. So kind of on a personal level, that's why I want to volunteer.
Volunteers will be paid somewhere around $5,000, and insurance would cover healthcare costs for any complications. They will quarantine in a special 19-bed unit at the Royal Free Hospital in London for an expected 2 weeks after virus exposure. Again, Andrew Ketchpole from hVIVO.
Our first priority when doing these studies is the safety of the volunteers. So for that reason, we have got very strict criteria about those who will be eligible to participate.
Volunteers must be between 18 and 30, healthy, with no pre-existing conditions. But there's a more controversial criteria that scientists are wrestling with right now, whether to exclude volunteers of color.
Because there is data to suggest that there is a potential for increased risk.
The UN says COVID-19 is disproportionately affecting racial and ethnic minorities around the globe, including in Brazil, the UK, and the US. According to UK government figures, black men in England and Wales are more than 2.5 times more likely to die of COVID-19 than white men. Some of that is explained by socioeconomic status and pre-existing conditions. But Dhillon Devakumar, a physician and professor at University College London, says it's more than that.
There are also other underlying causes, racism, discrimination, for example, being an underlying cause, which are not easy to account for in analysis such as this.
Devakumar studies the health impacts of racism and xenophobia. He says while it's important to note that race is a social construct and not biological, the effects of racism impact health in ways that can be hard to identify.
So you can't hold constant the discrimination someone has faced throughout their life. You can't hold constant the environment that someone's grown up in, the levels of air pollution, the kinds of housing that they've lived in throughout their life. So there are differences in outcomes amongst racial groups.
Devakumar isn't familiar with the specifics of this study proposal, but he says he can understand the reason for picking volunteers who are at the lowest possible risk for getting really sick. Charles Kwa Kordre, chief officer for the Caribbean and African Health Network, sees it differently.
Personally, it's really disappointing.
People of color are underrepresented in clinical trials. That's partly due to a legacy of racist medical experiments performed by white doctors. And Kwa Kordre says the idea of excluding people of color from this trial would add to the distrust.
The mistrust and the lack of trust has come about as a result of decades of sometimes how we need to respond so quickly. But what that is meant is that there's a whole section of people that are further marginalized, whose voices are not being heard.
HVIVO is still making a decision about whether and how to include people of color in the first phase of this trial, when they're testing out the safest way to infect people with the actual virus. The company hasn't designed protocols yet for the actual vaccine testing it hopes quickly follows. The volunteer criteria for this stage of the study will be finalized and handed over to UK regulators and an ethics panel by mid-November. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Okay, even if in theory the world gets an effective vaccine for COVID-19, a lot more is needed to get worldwide distribution. It'll be a complicated journey, no doubt. To get ready, UNICEF, the UN Children's Agency, recently said it was stockpiling more than 500 million syringes. Benjamin Schreiber knows all about the coming challenges. He's deputy chief for UNICEF's Global Immunization Program and joins us from New York.
It's a big task, and it's a big task for the whole world, and especially those health workers and all the people that are going to do the work in the end.
Benjamin, walk me through, if you would, the journey of a vaccine from the point of manufacture to deployment in someone's arm. Obviously, you need syringes, but what else is required?
When a vaccine is manufactured at global level, it needs to be shipped, or in most of the time it will be flown to the countries. It will land at the national level at the national warehouse, where national cold rooms exist where the vaccine is stored. They're temperature sensitive products. They need to be stored in cold environments. Normally vaccines need 2 to 8 degrees, so like your fridge at home. This vaccine then needs to be going out to the target populations across the whole country. So we are developing with or supporting the governments to develop deployment plans of how the vaccine goes from the national level towards the people that need it. And these people may sit in urban slums, they may sit in remote rural areas, or even in areas that are conflict affected. So we have to really plan very carefully ahead.
Benjamin, you spoke about our fridge at home. We can't obviously assume that refrigeration is widely available around the globe to keep these vaccines fresh. What does it mean that billions of people live in places without temperature-controlled storage?
Yes, that is the case. But we've been able to procure and install 40,000 vaccine fridges, many of them actually solar, because in many of these remote areas, there is no electricity or constant electricity. Even these fridges can keep on running and keep the vaccines cold for several days. And that means we now can have vaccinations in many more places than we were able to have before.
Your organization, UNICEF, Benjamin, is the largest single purchaser of vaccines in the world. So I'm guessing you know a fair amount about supply chains. Do you worry about any shortages of any resources that you need?
If we wouldn't be worried, then it would be too easy. I mean, we are worried about, so the lead time of introducing this vaccine is extremely short. We normally introduce a vaccine planning 12 to 24 months ahead with countries. We're now talking about introducing a vaccine with several months in terms of lead time. So we are already doubling down efforts and making sure that we can introduce that. There's good news that we have worked with governments over the last decade to introduce new vaccines in many countries. So there's a lot of expertise actually at the country level that we can build up on. But this is a vaccine that is not going to children. It's going to health workers and adult populations. So we need to tweak the approach a bit. And so my main concern is we need to be extremely flexible and adaptive to new circumstances and problems as they arise and need to problem solve constantly.
So there's coordination among countries, but does that mean that the supply chain won't be interrupted or broken in some way?
As the COVID pandemic hit many countries and kind of locked down flights, we've been able to continue supply routine or existing vaccines to all countries that need them. And we worked around it by working closely with the distribution and suppliers and also the aviation industry to secure flights, etc. So there's ways we can work around it, but it needs to be managed very carefully.
You've coordinated mass immunizations in the past, but we're talking now about a pandemic that requires a worldwide vaccination campaign. What do you see as the top challenge here, aside from just the sheer scale of the operation?
The operation needs extreme coordination across all governments, all partners. But there's also additional complexity given the questions people raise about and the kind of dis and misinformation that's circulating around the vaccines. So I think we have to not only manage the supply side, but also the demand side at country level.
Benjamin Schreiber is deputy chief for UNICEF's Global Immunization Program. Benjamin, thank you for your time.
Thanks a lot.
As the coronavirus continues to spread, international travel is basically a no-go. Vicarious thrills, though, no virus can take that away.
The beauty of wildlife photography is it's pulling you into a very different world where you've got an opportunity to see the world in such a different way.
Tim Littlewood is one of this year's judges for the Wildlife Photographer of the Year Award. London's Natural History Museum runs a competition. The judges sorted through nearly 50,000 images submitted by professionals and amateurs. The winner was announced by the Duchess of Cambridge, Kate Middleton.
Great pleasure that I can announce this year's Wildlife Photographer of the Year is Sergei Goshkov for his image, The Embrace.
The Embrace is a wonderful image of a Siberian tiger sitting up and hugging a large tree in Russia's Far East. The bark is well-worn. Contest judge Tim Littlewood says that shows that this is not the first time the big cat cozied up to this particular trunk.
It's like a rubbing post for the tigress, a bit like a domestic cat likes to rub against a tree or a branch scent marking.
It's a picture that's almost unreal, looks kind of like a painting. Littlewood describes the winning photo as having an autumnal look, with light peeking through the leaves onto the tiger's orange striped coat.
And the tigress is kind of in ecstasy. She's got her eyes closed, her face is into the sun. It's very captivating.
It is. A cat in utter bliss. Other finalists include a monkey meditating in Southeast Asia, a translucent frog grasping onto a branch in the Andes, and playful Pallas's cats bouncing through a field in Tibet, a scene that took 6 years to capture. Judge Littlewood said the photos don't just highlight natural beauty, they also remind us of the need to preserve natural environments.
We need to do something before we start losing all of these species, and we're losing them at such an enormous rate.
You can see the winning images and also enter next year's competition at London's Natural History Museum's website. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Nigeria's largest city, Lagos, reports are coming in of security forces opening fire tonight on unarmed demonstrators. The demonstrators had been protesting, in fact, against police brutality. According to several eyewitnesses, the live rounds hit several people. Details on casualties have not yet been confirmed. This evening's violence erupted after the Lagos state government imposed a 24-hour curfew in response to the growing protests against police violence. Yesterday, protesters blocked a major expressway in Lagos and also targeted the main airport, shutting down terminals. Chude Jidonwo is a lawyer and journalist in Lagos. Earlier today, I asked him how people in the city were responding to the curfew.
People are frenzied. People are panicked. People are canceling appointments. People are running home. Lagos is notorious for heavy traffic. Transportation is a nightmare. And so I just feel so sad for people who would have to be rushing home and they'll be caught on the road.
It's well before many people usually get home from work. I've even seen suggestions on Twitter cautioning those not close to home to head to a hotel. Why did authorities take such dramatic action? What prompted this?
Nigeria's security systems is a mess. They're incentivized to protect the powerful and the privileged against citizens. The government, in this atmosphere of chaos and unpredictability, must have made a strategic conclusion that the easiest thing to do is to keep everybody home. Just a sense of, we do not have the capacity to contain spiraling protests, and we should do the easiest thing for us to do to keep this under wraps. The problem with that is that citizens expect that the government should be taking action to protect constitutional protests. Citizens should not be punished for the government's inability to secure life and property, which, ironically, is the whole point of the protest in the first place. So while I can certainly appreciate the thinking that led to this, it's certainly not going to go well. Because even though you can say, yes, people understand that with chaos on the streets, the government was trying to get control of a fluid situation, citizens expected government to have thought of a better way to do this that doesn't infringe on the right of peaceful protest and the right to freedom of assembly.
So Chude, when you say the police system in Nigeria is a mess, a lot of Nigerians point first to SARS, the Special Anti-Robbery Squad, the unit that actually prompted all these protests. And now the demands of the protesters have grown beyond just a narrow focus on the SARS unit. What are protesters calling for now?
Any serious-minded, engaged government should have anticipated that the conditions that COVID-19 had presented would stimulate an already restless citizenry to get on the street. In Nigeria, young people overwhelmingly are tired of bad governance. They are tired of what appears to be a disengaged, disconnected government. That is the crux of the matter. People just feel like the governments are disconnected from the demands, the desires of everyday Nigerians. What people were really tired of is a government that doesn't care while the citizens die. That's the problem. And until citizens believe that the government is not just going to react to the protests in order to tamp it down, but the government understands that this is about disappointment in the system, the demands will keep on multiplying.
I know the young people of Lagos are especially incensed and have been on the streets. They've got a lot of popular support from celebrities who won't let the government off the hook, like the massively popular musician Burna Boy, who actually spoke to the BBC.
You have to understand that Nigeria is the biggest black nation in the face of the earth. If Nigeria can overcome and Nigeria can reach its full potential, and the youths can make sure that happens by rising up and fighting for their rights like they're doing at this time, then that's just going to be like a domino effect for the rest of the world.
Chude, is the federal government in Abuja and the state government in Lagos getting the message, and are they going to provide some satisfaction to the protesters?
They don't yet understand the depth of the discontent, because it is truly deep. Those who voted for this president, of which I am one, have been saying he has been a profound disappointment. Now, that understanding has eluded the authorities. And even now, they assume that young people will leave the streets after a short while. They've never witnessed a protest like this, as far as I know in our history, that has engaged the global diaspora of Nigerians. They've been protesting in Texas, protesting in D.C., protesting in New York, protesting in Montreal, protesting in Ontario, protesting in Pretoria. There was a protest this week in Trafalgar Square in London. Rather than humbly confront the disconnect between their assessment and the assessment of the Nigerian public, all they are trying to do is to end the protest. Unfortunately for them, that has never worked.
Chude Jidonwo lives in Lagos, where he's a lawyer and media entrepreneur. Thank you very much for giving us the latest, Chude.
Thank you.
Sounds for a moment of bliss. It's been a while since many of us felt blissed out. I'm guessing it's been, since the middle of March. So a tribute to a man who recently left us but brought bliss to thousands, probably more like millions of people. Jose Padilla, the DJ who for years worked the turntables on the Spanish resort island of Ibiza, creating what's been called the Balearic sound, as in the Balearic Islands off of Spain's Mediterranean coast. Chill out music, or the Ibiza sound. Whatever you call it, the music drew partiers from all over the globe to the island, where since 1991, DJ Jose Padilla has produced his soundtrack every evening at sunset at a bar called Café del Mar. In a recent documentary, Padilla told the story of coming to Ibiza for the first time. He was done with his native Barcelona for personal reasons and was ready to get on the first ferry out of the city. He ended up on the boat to Ibiza and instantly met some friendly people who showed him around the island.
And they took me out to Aguas Blancas to see the sun coming up. And I said, I like it. I'm staying here.
That was 1976. He worked as a waiter and sold mixtapes on the sidewalk until it became one of the island's main attractions. Judging from the eulogies for Jose Padilla in the YouTube comment section, it's clear he had an impact on people everywhere. They went to Ibiza for a dose of what Padilla was prescribing, bliss and chill. One of DJ Padilla's most requested tracks, remixed many, many times. That's Adios Ayer, Goodbye Yesterday. We say goodbye to DJ Jose Padilla, who died on Sunday of cancer at the age of 64. Before we take a break, I've got an important question for you. Have you heard our show produced exclusively for smart speakers? It's called The Number in the News. Here's the deal. One number, one story, every day. Yep, weekends too. You can find out more at theworld.org/smartspeaker. You're listening to The World. In the Dominican Republic, this artist is exploring her identity and gender and is getting monster praise for that, even if it might not sound that way.
In the DR, they call you that if you're, like, good at something, if it's sports or business or music or whatever. Like, they call you, you're a monster. You know, being a monster is like a good thing.
A fresh creative vision from the Caribbean. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World from PRX and GBH. It's an international mystery that seems ripped from a Cold War spy novel, U.S. diplomats coming down with mysterious brain ailments while posted overseas. In 2018, this was a reality for dozens of diplomats and spies posted at the U.S. Embassy in Cuba. Memory loss, blurred vision, mysterious sounds. The condition was given a name, Havana Syndrome. Today, a handful of diplomatic workers stationed in China and Russia are coming forward with their own similar experiences. Dr. David Relman is a Stanford professor working with the National Academies of Sciences to investigate Havana Syndrome, and he joins us from Stanford, California. First of all, what is Havana Syndrome? What are the health problems people have been experiencing?
It's a very perplexing and very unusual set of symptoms and signs. It afflicted people that were first recognized as having served in Havana with the U.S. Mission there. But it seems as though these are cases that have similarities to others from U.S. diplomats who have served elsewhere in the world as well.
I called the vector for the syndrome an attack. Is that fair, do you think?
It's a complicated story, and it is still not entirely clear exactly what has happened to all of these people. We at the National Academies were asked by the U.S. State Department to look at these cases with a fresh, objective, independent assessment and approach. And that is what we did. The National Academy set up a committee of 19 people, myself included. The committee had a great deal of expertise in neurology, some of the best neurology experts in the country, as well as electrical engineers and environmental health scientists toxicologists. And what we were asked to do was to look at these cases, try to understand them better from a clinical point of view, then look at a variety of possible mechanisms that would explain the cases. And finally, we were asked to comment upon how the U.S. government might address similar events like these should they occur again or continue into the future. And that's what we did. We completed all of these efforts. We wrote up a report that was submitted back to the State Department in early August and then waited to hear that they were ready for it to be released. And we have yet to hear a word from them.
So I know the report you've worked on has not been made public. You haven't heard back from the State Department, but can you tell us what you concluded?
I wish I could. And the answer is no, I cannot. But I do want to say our findings are important, not just for the patients, but the findings are important for the State Department itself, because providing greater clarity and an objective assessment of what we think may have happened should serve their interests in revealing the challenges that they faced and the challenges that they are going to face should similar cases occur again.
So, Dr. Rellman, you submitted the report to the State Department and you haven't gotten a reply yet from them. Why do you think that is?
We really don't know. I mean, the findings are complicated. It's not a black and white story in the end. And we know that the State Department has struggled to make good by their employees and try to sort this out so that they can not only improve the outcome for the people who have been affected, but also do what they can to prevent further cases from occurring.
There's been a criticism, as you know, of the Trump administration by some of the Foreign Service officers affected by this syndrome. The criticism that the White House hasn't done enough to stop future attacks. But if it's hard to know what the source is there anything that can be done?
Although I don't think that we, in any case, have a clear answer. We do have some ideas. We did arrive at a most plausible mechanism. So that certainly should be addressed in terms of prevention. This mechanism does suggest approaches that would be expected to minimize the likelihood of further cases.
Right. So a couple of news outlets have now reported on similar cases in Russia and China. Does that surprise you? I mean, to hear that there have been similar cases outside of Cuba, and does it help to confirm any of your conclusions?
Personally, I am not surprised. I'm not surprised in part because without a clear explanation for what may have happened, we can't say that these cases should have stopped occurring. And we are quite concerned as well about the possibilities of what might be the causes at play here.
Doctor, there's speculation that all of these cases that have been reported, it's an example of mass psychosis. Is that plausible?
While it's plausible, I would not want to let you believe that that is necessarily the answer.
Again, probably part of your findings in the report that has not been made public.
That's exactly true. I think that when the public can read our report, they will have greater insight and there will be greater clarity about what exactly happened here.
Are you going to pressure the State Department to get them to release your report?
We are trying our best, and it's in part why I'm speaking to you right now, is because we fervently hope that the State Department is listening and understands that we believe that it is in their best interest for our report to be made available to the U.S. public and to all who have vested interests in this incredibly important problem.
Dr. David Rellman, a professor at Stanford and chairman of the committee at the National Academies of Sciences investigating Havana syndrome. Thank you very much, Dr. Rellman.
You are most welcome.
With just 14 days to the general election, it makes sense that the incumbent would want to highlight a last-minute foreign policy success. President Donald Trump appeared to do just that on Monday with an announcement about Sudan. From Nairobi, the world's Halima Gikandi brings us that story.
Sudanese engineer Abdallah Khalil has been glued to the news for days, with CNN on his television, Facebook on his laptop, and Twitter on his phone.
Because there have been rumors and rumors and rumors every day, and everybody was so anxious. I slept like 4 a.m. yesterday, waiting for the tweet.
The tweet finally came yesterday from President Donald Trump's official account. He announced plans to remove Sudan from the U.S. state sponsors of terrorism list after more than 20 years. This is a big deal for 49-year-old Khalil. He lives in Ethiopia now, but he was born and raised in Sudan's capital, Khartoum.
It's a great news with my generation of people who are getting into 50, and we lost almost 6 years of our life.
30 years of his life, he says, living under the regime of former dictator Omar al-Bashir. Bashir was ousted from power in Sudan last year, but his administration gutted the country's economy and, according to the United States, provided shelter and support for al-Qaeda terrorists. Years of punishing U.S. sanctions have helped cut off Sudan from the international banking system.
It was always a challenge to open a bank account. Every country I go to, it was a serious challenge to just have a bank account.
Khalil saw the sanctions as punishment aimed at ordinary Sudanese. Successive U.S. administrations have discussed removing Sudan from the terrorism list over the years. That talk ramped up in the past year, following the ouster of Bashir, who's in jail in Khartoum. The current Sudanese government is now led by civilians and military leaders. They've prioritized removing Sudan from the terror list, says Jihad Mashamoun. He's a Sudanese political analyst based in the UK.
Even in the early days of the establishment of the government, all their programs were focused on removing Sudan from the state-sponsored terrorist list.
Behind-the-scenes negotiations between the U.S. and Sudan continued this year, but removal has hinged on some outstanding issues, in particular payments to victims of the 1998 terrorist attacks on U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania.
The debt for the bombing of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania and the U.S. coal ship, there's going to be paid, the reparations are going to be paid for that.
But there's been a big debate about how much Sudan should actually shell out. In the deal negotiated with the U.S., Sudan will pay more than $300 million to victims. That's only a fraction of the total decided by the courts. But it's still a lot of money for a struggling economy with massive debt. Khalil, the engineer, was in Sudan last week.
The people, the Sudanese people, are suffering from many things. No bread, no fuel, queues everywhere.
That's one reason why there's been so much international pressure to remove Sudan from the U.S. terror listing. But Jihad Mashamoun says things have become even more complicated in recent months.
It took, of course, a particularly interesting turn when Trump's administration suggested that Sudan may normalize relations with Israel.
That's a politically sensitive issue in Sudan, says Mashamoun. Not everyone in the current Sudanese government supports the idea of establishing diplomatic relations with Israel. And the same goes for the Sudanese public. President Trump did not mention Israel in his announcement on Twitter. And for now, excitement about the prospect of Sudan being taken off the terrorism list is running high. Last night, Sudan's Prime Minister, Abdullah Hamdok, talked about it as a major achievement. For Hamdok, this would be a huge opportunity domestically. But Trump's Twitter declaration is not the end of the story. The U.S. Congress still needs to review and approve the president's decision, and that could take several months. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
The U.S. Justice Department has charged 6 Russian intelligence officers in connection with major worldwide cyber attacks, including hacking elections in France. Assistant Attorney General for National Security John Demers made the announcement yesterday. He said the men charged stand accused of conducting
the most disruptive and destructive series of computer attacks ever attributed to a single group.
Andy Greenberg joins me now. He's the author of Sandworm, A New Era of Cyber War and the Hunt for the Kremlin's Most Dangerous Hackers. Andy, first of all, what do we know about the people being charged?
We know that they are 6 Russian men, and they are part of Russia's military intelligence agency called the GRU. The GRU is this very mysterious and secretive intelligence agency. There have been only a few defectors from it in its entire history, and usually they're killed. So the actual sort of hierarchy and how these guys work, we only know bits and pieces of it. But I think the more important thing about them is that these are hackers who are responsible for an incredible rampage across the internet over the last 5 years, from causing blackouts in Ukraine to releasing this piece of malware called NotPetya, which was the worst cyber attack in history.
Give us some more specifics on the attack on Ukraine's power grid. What happened there?
In December of 2015, just before Christmas, Sandworm attacked a collection of Western Ukrainian electric utilities. They took over the mouse movements of the operators in a control room of these facilities and locked them out of the computer. And these poor operators in this Western Ukrainian electric utility were forced to watch as their own mouse clicked through circuit breakers and turned off the power to 250,000 Ukrainian civilians. They even bombarded it with fake phone calls just to kind of add another layer of chaos. It was a truly unique and brutal kind of cyber attack.
So you mentioned NotPetya, the NotPetya attack. Officials are saying that was perhaps the most damaging cyber attack ever detected. You agree with that?
I definitely do. And I think it was an underreported attack at the time. NotPetya was pushed out to thousands of networks in Ukraine and around the world. And it spread incredibly virulently, taking over entire computer networks in seconds and essentially destroying all of the computers. And this took down not just hundreds of companies inside of Ukraine, but also it did hundreds of millions of dollars of damage to companies like Merck, the New Jersey pharmaceutical firm, and FedEx, and Maersk, the world's largest shipping firm. Each one of these companies suffered damages unlike we usually see for any cyber attack. And when you add them all up, the White House estimated that NotPetya cost at least $10 billion.
Well, if this indictment sounds familiar, members of Russia's GRU were previously charged for trying to interfere in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Notably, in this announcement, Andy, no one's being charged for trying to interfere in the current U.S. election. Does that surprise you?
It does slightly, in the sense that the timing of this seems like it should be about trying to preempt or prevent an attack on the 2020 election. But actually, every part of our response to the GRU, both in the Obama administration and in the Trump administration, has been so retroactive, has taken years to coalesce. Sometimes even just a simple statement holding Russia accountable has taken as long as 8 or 9 months after that NotPetya attack, for instance. Governments around the world have to take deterrence of cyber attacks and responding to them, holding the hackers accountable more seriously and act faster.
What has the U.S. done in recent years in terms of cyber defense? Like, how vulnerable is America's cybersecurity infrastructure right now, 2 weeks before the general election?
Our government has done a lot to try to secure itself, especially, and to secure American critical infrastructure. But we remain vulnerable because we have a complex society. We've seen a warning from Microsoft just in the past weeks, in fact, that another GRU unit has been targeting, for instance, political consultancies and other election-related organizations, and maybe trying to do a kind of hack and leak operation of the kind that they did against the Democratic National Committee and the Clinton campaign in 2016. So those are soft targets. They're not something that the NSA or the Department of Homeland Security can secure themselves. So it's very difficult to kind of put an umbrella of protection over all these different targets.
What do you think is the Kremlin's motivation in all of these attacks?
Well, the story of Sandworm begins in Ukraine, and Russia is, of course, at war in Ukraine. Russia physically invaded Ukraine, and the cyber war that Russia has waged there has contributed to that, has helped create the sense that Ukraine is a country at war, that it's destabilized, that it's not a place to put your foreign investment, for instance. And then, in other cases, the attack on the Olympics, for instance, that seems like kind of pure pettiness. Russia was banned from those Olympics for doping and retaliated by trying to break the technological backbone of the event, almost as if to say, if we can't enjoy these Olympics, then no one will. It seems like it could just be that simple.
You know, for 4 years, we've heard the accusation, Russian hacking, so many times that I wonder if it starts to lose its meaning, not to mention the already well-worn trope of the Russians as the enemy. Andy, you've got deep knowledge and expertise in all of this. What do you think is at stake with Russian hacking operations? Just generally, what does Russia see as its endgame with all of these influence operations?
I do think it's unfortunate that Russian hacking has become this kind of politicized issue. But if you excise all those political narratives and just look at what Russia has done, I do think that they objectively have done the most disruptive and destructive cyber attacks that we've ever seen. So I do think that we have to stay vigilant, that we have to hold the Kremlin accountable for the attacks that it has done, and we have to try to secure ourselves against future ones.
Andy Greenberg is a senior writer at Wired. His book is Sandworm, A New Era of Cyber War and the Hunt for the Kremlin's Most Dangerous Hackers. Andy, good to have you with us again. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
2 weeks now to Election Day, and campaigns are urgently trying to get out the vote. But the push to get more Latinos registered to vote, that's been going on for decades.
Les habla su amigo Ricardo Montalbán. Les quiero pedir un favor.
Actor Ricardo Montalbán back in the 1980s telling people, the vote gives us the voice we need. 30 years later, Latinos are the second largest ethnic voting bloc in the U.S. Writer Michelle Garcia has looked into this and joins me from New York City. So you've pointed out that Latinos are still building a legacy of their own when it comes to the vote. What do you mean by legacy?
Right. So remember the photo of the congressional representatives, women, all dressed in white? That was to mark the passage of the 19th Amendment that gave white women the right to vote a century ago this year. Black voters are understood within the context of their long civil rights struggle and efforts to get to the ballot box, many of which also benefited Latinos. But there's little context for Latino voters. Most people are not taught that Latinos, too, had to face literacy tests, poll taxes. This context is important for understanding that when Latinos turn out to the polls, it represents the overcoming of decades of suppression and neglect.
You know, Michelle, so much of the narrative is about how a candidate reaches the Latino voters, or as they say, the Latino vote. What should we be paying attention to instead?
I spoke with Frances Negron Moutner, who's an associate professor at Columbia University, and she told me that Latino context is often working in coalition. For example, Puerto Ricans working with African Americans in New York and Chicago. She said that Latinos have contributed to the political history of this country with movements around labor, gender, and immigration. To see Latino voters and the multiple movements that Latinos have organized reframes the voting story, and it becomes a constellation of stories.
And I think that's very frightening for some people, particularly those that benefit from the current arrangements of power, because if you had multiple stories and you have multiple perspectives, then you would have to, you know, it would be a totally different relationship between groups.
That's Frances Negron speaking with my guest, Michelle Garcia. So, well, we've seen how the political system has ignored Latinos, which is partly why they face constant suppression at the polls. Yet candidates are always seeking their vote at some point in their campaigns. What needs to change here?
I spoke with Irene Godinez from the North Carolina group Poder NC.
We are no longer that transient community that people thought we were going to be. We're not going anywhere. We are North Carolinians, and we are carving out space for ourselves in North Carolina politics and in the landscape in general, because we have long been ignored, have long been taken for granted. And with our organizations, we're saying not anymore.
When I asked Godinez if she drew inspiration from Cesar Chavez's 1960s farm worker movement in California, she said no. She's the daughter of Mexican farm workers in North Carolina, but she pointed instead to the inspiration she finds in current movements in Mexico and to the Black civil rights movement in her state. To your question about what needs to change, all of this is critically important to understanding and situating Latinos in a context. What Latino voters mean in the long history of this country's struggle towards voting rights.
So, Michelle, the picture then, I guess, needs to just be wider and more nuanced of who the Latino voters are.
Absolutely. And when we look at the current election through that more nuanced story, we realize that history is being made right now.
Writer and journalist Michelle Garcia. Michelle, thanks very much.
Thank you.
In the Dominican Republic, musician Rita Indiana is a household name, but the pressure of fame and a same-sex relationship made her leave home for Puerto Rico, where she lives today. Rita Indiana says she can be more open there. It's safer to do your own thing, to express queer identity. Creativity is at the heart of Indiana's work, whether it's through her books or music. She's just released her first album in 10 years with this heavy single, Como un Dragón. Suena la sirena, regreso la mostra pa' comerse los de cena. Como un dragón. Now, in the video for the single Como un Dragón, it looks like you're the narrator of some dystopian sci-fi story. There's an alien-like egg, which actually looks like the coronavirus, and from it flies out these little red eyes. What is going on? What were you imagining?
Well, the song was written and the video was made before the coronavirus, and it was directed by my wife, Noelia Quintero Herencia, who does pretty much all the visual stuff for the project. And we were just being a little whimsical about it and having me come back as a little monster, which is my one of my alias, La Montra, you know, having a little fun with me coming back and getting out of the cave. The thing is, like with the project, like everything took another meaning when the whole coronavirus, you know, thing exploded. And I started saying that the album was a songbook for the apocalypse, being a little frivolous about it and funny, but it wasn't funny anymore when it hit, you know, January and February and then March with the lockdown.
It certainly feels urgent still, though. Why'd you get the nickname La Mostra?
Well, in the DR, they call you that if you're, like, good at something, if it's sports or business or music or whatever. Like, they call you, you're a monster. You know, being a monster is like a good thing. And I loved it because I'm a big fan of horror films and heavy metal, and I'm, like, 6'3", you know, like, really lanky and weird. So it was a good name in many ways. Una moneda está en el fondo de un pozo, la tiré un día y pedí de tú y del otro. Una moneda dando vuelta en el aire, cayó del lado de la apuesta de alguien. Hola, moneda, hay que hacerla, hola, moneda, hay que hacerla.
Your new album is called Mandinga Times. Mandinga is a pretty controversial word in Caribbean history. It goes back to West Africa and the transatlantic slave trade. Can you explain the meaning and why you see these times as Mandinga times?
Yeah, Mandinga is a word that it's one of the biggest ethnic groups that were brought here during the slave trade. And it is a word that means a lot of things in Latin America. And there's a lot of places, beaches, towns, barrios that are called Mandinga. And most of the words are used to demonize certain minorities, like people from the LGBT community, black people, people who are considered witches because they practice religions that are not non-Christian. And it's also in the Dominican Republic, it means like getting beat up. Mandinga is like a when they beat you up in a group. So it was a word that in a way spoke about these times, you know, and many aspects of the times we're living, and that's where it comes from.
Dominican musician Rita Indiana. You can check out the video to Como un Dragón. We posted it on our Twitter. We're at The World. Coming to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow. From PRX.